So when you first
it's our county manager's meeting, so Mr. County Manager, Michael Colley, your meeting.
Thank you, sir. Good morning, counselors. As you're well aware, healthcare is in a state of evolution, and Clark County is moving ahead with the early adopter of consolidated healthcare, including mental health, substance abuse, and physical health. And we're working very closely with the healthcare authority at the state to implement this under the leadership of Vanessa Gaston, our community services director. And so we thought it appropriate at this time, because we have a decision we have to make here in the next few days or weeks regarding the early adopter program. And we thought that we would bring the healthcare authority down to answer any questions you might have and let you know authoritatively what the program entails. So with that, I'll turn it over to Vanessa, and she can make introductions.
So again, good morning, counselors. Good morning, people in the audience. We have a number of people from the healthcare authority, and I want to thank them for traveling from Olympia to do a presentation. After this, they will head to Skamania County and do the same presentation. So before I introduce them, I just want to thank the providers in the community, the behavioral health, the primary care, the MCOs, members of the Regional Health Alliance, County Auditor Chris Horn, and the budget office, and my staff in public health, who are really working to get us to this point. So what you're going to hear today is a culmination of a lot of work that has taken up over for a number of months. And so I'm very proud of our community for getting us to this point. So I'm going to hand this over, because most of the presentation is going to be from the healthcare authority. So I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves and their actual titles, so you'll know exactly where they're working for as part of the form. Thank you.
Thank you, counselors. I'm Mary Ann Linda Blad, I'm the Medicaid Director of the Healthcare Authority.
I'm Nathan Johnson. I'm Chief Policy Officer of the Healthcare Authority. Good to be with you.
And we have two staff with us today that I would also like to introduce, Jenny Hamilton and Isabel Jones. So I'll go ahead and get started. And again, counselors, thank you for this opportunity to speak with you here in Vancouver about this very important initiative at the Healthcare Authority that we're doing together with Clark County, and that's launching early adopter. As you know, the legislature passed, Senate Bill 6312 in 2014 and set forth a policy direction for the state to integrate Medicaid behavioral and physical health benefits into a single accountable entity into managed care by the year 2020. We also made the offer for counties that were ready to pursue full integration earlier on an earlier timeline, an option that was known in the legislation as the early adopter, and that was created as part of that legislation. In January of this year, Clark County Council, thank you, provided Healthcare Authority with a non-binding letter of intent declaring your interest in pursuing the early adopter initiative. And in doing so, you were the first region in the state to move towards that fully integrating physical and behavioral health benefits and providing better coordinated and whole person care to your constituents. And this is very important, and I again really want to thank you for that, because it's really paying that, attention to the importance of really delivering services around the person's needs and really around whole person care. So since that time, we have been working what seems to be around the clock with your staff and here at the county to implement the early adopter initiative in a way that ensures the program will work for here in Southwest Washington. One of our core principles that guides this work is local engagement. We are committed to engaging with a broad spectrum of local partners in the implementation process to successfully transform and integrate the system in partnership with the local community. I would like to take a moment to personally thank Vanessa Gaston, Dr. Alan Melnick, Dee Dee Sealer, and Andy Silver from Clark County, who have been participants on an implementation team with our staff and provided the local expertise we needed to move forward with the planning and policy design. I'm very encouraged to see the partnership that has developed over the last several months with the county, the Regional Health Alliance, and the state. And I hope we can use this model for local engagement in future products. It was a great experience for all of us. So today, Nathan and I are here to speak to you about early adopter, to provide you an update on implementation progress since your letter in January, and to answer any questions you may have before providing a formalized commitment to us like June 1st. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Nathan, who is our Chief Policy Officer, to kick off the presentation. And again, I want to thank you for partnering with us on this very important endeavor and inviting us to join you today. So thank you.
And councillors, thank you again for this opportunity. It is a true privilege to be working with you and your team to implement early adopters, being the first region in the state to take this forward. This is an evolution that is part of a broader picture of trying to bring better care to individuals, bottom line, and achieve a triple aim that we call it, which is we want better health in our communities overall, we want better care delivery, and we want a more sustainable delivery system that ultimately delivers lower costs over time, and that drives most of everything we're doing in the healthcare authority today. My job today is to be brief in summarizing the Early Adopter Initiative, allowing plenty of time for our engagement and any questions you might have. To that extent, if I start getting along too fast here, please stop me. I really appreciate your questions and interruptions along the way to make sure this is a valuable presentation for you this morning. And again, what I managed to just do is mess up the slideshow, so can somebody fix that for me? Let's see here. Okay, we got it. I'll hit the right button next time. So what you see in front of you is an overview. We are on a transition pathway, as Marianne was expressing, that's dictated by the legislature, which by 2020, this entire state will have an integrated managed care delivery system that combines three threads that are very separate in today's Medicaid delivery system. The physical health side, or what we can also call the medical delivery system, and the mental health delivery system, especially for seriously mentally ill individuals who today receive most of their services through the regional support network. And the third strain, chemical dependency services, or services for the substance abuse disorders that members of our community suffer from. So this offers the opportunity to integrate those services that are today very, very fragmented in a standard integrated delivery model with single line accountability for the outcomes of those services delivered. But it is a transitional pathway, and not every region of this state has elected to go forward on the Early Adopter Initiative. So those counties, those regions of this state, are moving forward with a still bifurcated model between Apple Health managed care plans you see reflected on this slide and what we call behavioral health organizations. Again, those organizations will be responsible for delivering some mental health for the seriously mentally ill population and all chemical dependency services. Bottom line, no matter what, by January 1, 2020, this entire state will resemble the fully integrated managed care delivery system that this region has decided to explore a little bit earlier. In addition, I might highlight before I move on to this slide that the legislature provided an incentive for regions that elect this early adopter option. We will talk a little bit more about this over the presentation. But any region that does elect early adopter integration by April 2016 is entitled to share in the savings that the state experiences in its Medicaid program up to 10%. This, of course, is dictated by ensuring that the quality of the system is maintained and performance is improved, but that this county and set of counties that are under consideration for early adopter in Southwest Washington will be entitled to savings. This is the first time our legislature has considered an approach like this that shares in the state's accumulation of any savings for a Medicaid innovation of this nature, so it is pretty exceptional. So whole person care, what do we mean by this, and how is it reflected in the draft contract that is moving forward? First and foremost, we believe it's necessary to drive co-location of primary care and behavioral health services. Not just co-location, but collaboration between the provider community themselves of primary care, mental health, and chemical dependency professionals. Coordination of the services and other services that impact this population considerably from their both better health, better care, and cost perspective. Jointly funding care coordinators available at the site of care. Today we have a lot of care coordination, but it's very siloed, very fragmented. And sometimes when you have a lot of needs, you have five or six care coordinators trying to figure out how to help you in those needs. We envision a much more coordinated and integrated approach here. And streamlined care coordination where at least there's one point person, it's clear, that's delivering the necessary services to meet that person's needs, even as we still have a delivery system with specialty services across it. We'll go to the next slide here. So purchasing in early adopter regional service areas. First and foremost, Marianne suggested this already, And the legislature has dictated this. There is to be local decision making. In fact, the early adopter initiative, as you know, does not move forward without the county councilors in this county and Skamania County authorizing its movement forward. We are seeking that formal letter of intent, as I think you're aware, by June 1st. Second, there will be managed care organizations, or MCOs for short, that's the acronym you'll hear throughout this presentation, that are at risk for the full continuum of services, physical, mental health, and chemical dependency. In some ways, counties that are today, through their RSN, responsible for some financial risk for behavioral health services, that risk will transition to managed care entities. Their admin load will be limited. Today in contracts, for instance, for our blind disabled population, we build rates that limit their administrative burden to 8.7%. We think this helps ensure that the vast majority of dollars our plans are being provided are going into direct service delivery. Also important in a managed care environment is consumer choice, meaning that there is not going to be a single entity delivering these services, but at least two. Federal law requires this, and we believe it is very advantageous to give consumers in any region of the state, whether they are an early adopter region or not, some level of choice over the plan that will help deliver their services, much like we all get choices for the most part with our health plans. And I think finally and importantly, as you deliberate on this issue, we are absolutely trying to ensure no unfunded mandates in this initiative. Medicaid benefits will continue to be defined by the state plan, which is the vehicle that ensures an agreement between the state and federal government with regard to the Medicaid program. And HCA will not be adding new benefits that have not been funded by the legislature. And in fact, even if we wanted to, we could not do that because of the legislature's authorization in this area. So we've identified with your staff and with broad community discussions some benefits of the early adopter model that we want to ensure take hold in this community. First, seamless access to necessary services. Today, people in our state and in our communities must navigate a myriad, at times a very confusing myriad, of service delivery systems that have been created over decades of always trying to do the right thing and bring necessary services to people, but it's resulted in a very fragmented, very siloed delivery system for the clients we serve. The ability to address physical health and behavioral health issues in one system with better coordinated care, one key advantage of this approach. Opportunity that is unique to the early adopter approach for local input that will shape this program. I think we're already very effectively modeling that behavior through our early implementation activities, and that will continue until we get to implementation in April 1 of 2016, and will continue long after that, and we'll be talking about some ways that will take hold. Better aligning financial incentives for expanded prevention and treatment and improved outcomes. When you have siloed delivery system approaches with siloed financing, oftentimes what happens is the financial incentives become very misaligned, and with no single point of accountability, it's not always clear who has the accountability for the performance of the delivery system, both from a financial and care delivery perspective. That is something early adopter approach is addressing. Also, an adequate and sustainable network that ensures access and continuity of care. Today, again, as a result of decades of building upon systems of care that we have in the state, we don't always have a continuum of services available to individuals. There's ultimately some cliffs in the system depending on what diagnosis you have or the severity of your illness. We're trying to address that. Flexible models of care that support the use of care teams that are interdisciplinary in nature, meaning that we will leverage the full spectrum of the health workforce in this community to deliver services without some of the financial and programmatic constraints that exist today. I alluded to this already, but shared savings. We have the opportunity to reinvest savings from this initiative back in the delivery system. I think that's very critical, and the legislature having provided this opportunity is quite exceptional to what we've seen in the past. And then improving information and administrative data sharing across systems. I think it's worth noting that it's very hard to deliver integrated care, care centered on the whole person, without data streams and providers, for that matter, that can talk to each other freely. So I'm going to move us forward here and talk a little bit about a timeline. I think you'll appreciate that I'm not going to try to unpack for you, and probably for everyone's eyes too, every single detail of this, but there are several critical milestones, one in fact that we're very focused on for today, which is we do need your binding letter of interest as soon as possible, and by June 1st ideally, to move this initiative forward. Up until and leading up to this point, there has been significant work to develop a draft contract that reflects the binding nature of agreements the state will have with its managed care organizations and the role that the county and regional health alliance will be playing in delivering those services and ensuring the accountability for delivery of those services. We do intend a fully integrated request for procurement, which is the way we contract or get to contract with our managed care plans, being released by July with responses due in August, and ultimately hope to have those plans that will be delivering these services selected by the fall in October. The other thing this timeline indicates is there are parallel paths, as I suggested earlier, and similar processes are taking place across every region of the state because no region is maintaining the status quo. So the early adopter initiative. I think one thing that this initiative allows us to zoom in to a much greater degree is local accountability. Not just local accountability as it relates to the RSN's oversight of the seriously mentally ill population, not local accountability as it relates to some of the funding streams tied to chemical dependency services, but in fact local accountability that spans the entire system and gives role to community actors in this particular region that is going to be unique to this particular region. So there are a few roles and responsibilities. I won't, in fairness and in interest of time, go through every one of these, but I'd like to highlight a few of them. And in this case, we've split out those roles and responsibilities between the healthcare authority, counties, and the regional health alliance. Starting with the healthcare authority, final accountability for all contracts in all regional service areas. I think it's important to stress that the state maintains, under its statute, the absolute responsibility for ensuring the performance of the Medicaid delivery system and the absolute responsibility for ensuring that the contracts are overseen. What we intend to do is share in this responsibility, but the buck stops with us, and we want to be clear with you that we still maintain that ultimate accountability to you and to our authorizing environment. We'll also be providing some technical assistance funds to ensure prompt and successful implementation of the early adopter initiative. We will be collecting data from our plans, from our delivery systems, so that the county and community can understand and work with that data and share with us the feedback and monitoring role that today is somewhat driven by an individual consumer complaint, and we kind of do it on a one-off basis. What we're suggesting is a systemic and constant feedback loop that will inform our contracting activity and our oversight activity, and that's a big change. For the county, determining whether to become an early adopter, that is your first crucial and very primary role before any other roles take place. But you've also already designated members for an implementation team, and there will be more formality to that again as we go forward. Development of contract language is a shared responsibility and one that the counties have been very engaged in. You'll be designating members ultimately on the feedback and monitoring team that I just alluded to. That's a very crucial role to ensure the success of this initiative. And you'll be alerting us on systemic issues that take place, both in the lead-up to April 2016 and after implementation, ensuring that we're all getting to that triple aim objective of better health for our constituents, better care delivery for our constituents, and ultimately at a more sustainable rate as it relates to cost. And for the RHA, they're going to help us with creating mechanisms for receiving and analyzing performance data. They, too, will have a role in the feedback and monitoring process and will be designating members, again, across your community to that role. They will be alerting HCA to health system issues that exist at a local level and may not be in place across the state. We also envision them adopting a regional behavioral health advisory board to approve the regional plan for use of mental health block grant and substance abuse prevention and treatment block grant funds. And ultimately, the RHA will be critical for ensuring collaboration between all of the member parts. There is the state, there is the county. We're really focused on that relationship today, but there are many, many others around that RHA table that can contribute to the success of this initiative because it reflects all of the sectors that the populations we serve are interacting with, and it's very important to gauge them all in an initiative of this magnitude. So moving ahead here. So phase one of county responsibility, specifically on the implementation team. At present, it includes representatives from Clark and Skamania counties as well as representatives of the RHA. It will draft and review contract language with the healthcare authority and has already been doing that. It is reviewing all key early adopter legal policy and fiscal decisions, and the county authority will need to submit a binding letter of their intent by June 1st, 2015 to absolutely effectuate the contracting process that will move forward for early adopter. You will also be reviewing and assessing health plan readiness with the healthcare authority, which will include the elements in front of you, and we can come back to them if there's greater interest in those. Here are some examples of further local input. Already, there have been key policy decisions in the following areas that reflect feedback from the implementation team. For instance, the design of the crisis model. Designed to serve non-Medicaid clients regionally, importantly, as we talk about, especially the behavioral health delivery system and the crisis response nature of it, we recognize that it's not just Medicaid clients that will be interacting with this system we're creating, so that's important. The design to allocate block grant funds that are not tied to the Medicaid program but are coming from federal sources. The requirements for care coordination from our managed care delivery systems. The covered services list, again, to be very clear on what services are in and out of the contract. Network adequacy requirements. The role of the county in monitoring. You've heard me express some of our findings in that area. The role of a regional ombudsman, again, to ensure appropriate and timely care delivery. And the role of that Behavioral Health Advisory Committee and its capacity going forward. Phase two, as we move into the monitoring responsibilities, this will activate April 2016 with the implementation of the full implementation of the Early Adopter Initiative. It would be, as we envision it, comprised of at least one representative from each county, as well as representatives from the RHA. It will develop that rapid response feedback loop, which again is going to be engineered to ensure we're not just basing our own acknowledgement of performance on consumer complaints or one-off anecdotes, but instead a systemic look at the system and how it's performing. We'll identify high-risk areas to focus monitoring and any corrective action that needs to take place at either the delivery system or managed care organization level. And then again, as we discussed, sharing data across the partners to allow this feedback and monitoring process to take hold. Specific county responsibilities will be continued, including the designation of mental health professionals under present statute. Commitments under the ITA will continue to be processed, of course, through the county court system, as well as jail and transition services that the county will continue to administer through the criminal justice treatment account and the funding sources attached. Those items do not change in the way of county responsibility under the present statute. So there are a few additional issues, and again, in being sensitive to time, I hope I won't rush through these, but I do want to cover them briefly. Any funds not spent for the provision of services must be returned to the state. That is what the statute dictates as it relates to reserves in the present regional support networks. The state will be seeking authority from CMS and the legislature to reinvest any remaining reserves back into the services in this community in the two-county early adopter region. HCA and DSHS are both fully committed to that reality and reinvesting all of the reserves back into the region. And potential reinvestment areas are identified as follows. Medicaid funds could be reinvested in the provision of actual behavioral health services via Medicaid managed care plans. Non-Medicaid funds could conceivably be reinvested into the crisis response system for the provision of services that may not be tied to a particular Medicaid enrollee or set of enrollees. The most recent reserve numbers that we're aware of for unencumbered Medicaid services is $15.9 million and unencumbered non-Medicaid services $1.3 million, to put that into perspective. You heard me suggest that shared savings is a pretty exceptional thing here, and I think it's worthy of a little more focus in this quick presentation. Legislature has never agreed to share savings for a Medicaid initiative in the way that it has under the present statute. Payments are targeted at 10% of any savings realized by the state. They will be based and tied to outcome and performance measures. This is not just about squeezing a budget. This is about doing the right things at the care delivery level to ensure that savings accrue over time. It is available under the statute for up to 6 years or until fully integrated managed care is in place at the date of January 1, 2020. That's the legislative dictate. And there is a directive to reinvest this savings through counties. It is a county decision, ultimately, as to how it will govern the reinvestment of those savings. The methodology for this savings calculation is under development with consulted actuaries. Of course, this must pass the straight-face test within our own authorizing environment, legislature, as well as our broader authorizing environment with the federal government that has a great interest in this as well. Two components are specifically under consideration at the moment. Upstream savings, which is anticipating savings that is incorporated into our rate-setting process. Without going into too much detail, when we contract with a managed care delivery system, we set a rate on the front end. And if we are assuming savings as a result of this initiative, there are upfront savings that will be identified through that process and will be essentially immediately available or more immediately available for reinvestment. There's also downstream reconciliation as we measure after a certain point in time the success of this initiative across those performance and outcome measures and by looking at the actual budget performance that occurred. And I'm sure we might want to come back to that if folks have any questions on that. We have some guiding principles for how we want to measure performance of this new delivery system that's being conceived. We want the measure set to be of a manageable size. What we know is if there's dozens, in some cases our delivery systems are interacting with hundreds of different ways that they're measured, it makes it very hard to focus on anything if you're focusing on hundreds of things in terms of how you're going to be measured. So we want to be very crystal clear with you, with the delivery systems, with our managed care organizations on how we are going to monitor and measure their performance, which means a list of a very manageable size. We want the measure set to reflect state priorities and local priorities. There should be a sufficient numerator and denominator in that measure set so that we know we're not dealing with 10 people that are being measured for a very, very specific purpose. We want something that reflects the whole of the community experience. The measure set also needs to consider the experience of all populations, including high-risk populations, those that actually cost us the most to serve, whether we're serving them in the Medicaid delivery system or at times serving them through other social service offerings or, in fact, the jail system if we're not successful. Measures are based on readily available healthcare insurance claims clinical data. We understand there are limits to what data can provide in the way of measure and monitoring services. Preference should be given to nationally vetted measures. We don't have the time or the energy necessarily to be making up a bunch of measures, and our delivery systems can't take any more made-up measures, if you will, for monitoring their performance. So we're very mindful to be as standardized as possible as we roll these out. And it should, to the degree possible, reflect consistency across the regional service areas as early adopter integration becomes a statewide phenomenon over the next several years. Before you have, reflecting these principles, our first 10 draft measures, which have been vetted both internally and externally up until now. They are not absolutely finalized, but this is how we're leaning in terms of the most line-of-sight measures. I will say from a monitoring perspective, this is not everything, but from accountability perspective, this is where we want our delivery systems and our plans to focus. I think I made it through in the prescribed amount of time. I want to take a breath here and allow you maybe to do the same and see what type of questions you might have with regard to this overall initiative, both from how healthcare authority is thinking about it and then if there's any follow-up items you might have for us as you deliberate on the June 1st deadline. So thank you very much for your time.
I do have a question, and I'm sure someone here has an answer. We talked about this being a comprehensive plan, and we talked about it including housing support services, employment services, transportation services. So without going into deep detail, housing support services, would we use some existing organizations, local organizations that work on specifically that problem and those issues?
So let me address that, Counselor. So we currently in Clark County, well, every county has to do a homeless plan. And so the city, Clark County, and the Vancouver Housing Authority have come jointly together, and we have the Council for the Homeless is our main coordinator. So we have a comprehensive plan that you just approved, and they are the kind of centralized care coordination for all of our housing and homeless services.
This benefits them because they're already ahead of the game. So they have all the providers who meet regularly through the coalition of providers to provide those services. Now, with the whole care coordination is you will have a care coordinator in those provider agencies and with the MCO that this person, that the care coordinators in the housing system can actually call. Because right now they do not really know how to connect with the different systems. So this will help to coordinate already what's been coordinated in the housing piece. Now, we have limited funds in housing, so we, you know, we have a huge need. So we have to try to prioritize and try to make sure we're addressing what the federal government through HUD is trying to do, as well as the State Department of Commerce. So this is how that would benefit that.
So, and that really answers my question. We're not redeveloping new programs. We are going to look at an interaction and communication within existing programs. And for transportation services, that's also important that be a comprehensive part of this. So we will connect with what we're doing locally, and it'll be a more formal communication system.
Absolutely.
Where you know who the go-to people are.
Yes, absolutely. And I can't remember the name of the regional transportation group that focuses on disabled and vulnerable populations, but I know my staff participate on that. I think they have monthly meetings, and they do talk about transportation issues as well as where's the access to the services. And so this will also be started to be part of that conversation.
Sounds very interesting. Thank you.
I do. Thank you for that presentation. It's quick and a lot to absorb, and it's kind of rounded around the edges. Where does Medicare fit into this? Because one of the things that I've experienced is the Veterans Administration and Medicare is somewhat involved, but not necessarily in the Medicaid process.
I can speak to that briefly. You know, a lot of our Medicaid beneficiaries that we serve are dually eligible, so they're in Medicare as well. And one of the things that Medicare on the federal side is very interested in is ensuring coordination for those individuals. Oftentimes they have very high needs and very high costs, so the state and the federal government have a great deal of interest. To that end, one of the programs we've had that specifically targets that population and very much fits into the forward-looking discussion and could in fact be even improved upon as part of the early adopter initiative is the Health Homes program, which provides ample coordination and additional services for those populations that are of highest risk. Those beneficiaries that are on Medicare and Medicaid at the same time are a particular population of focus for that initiative. And it's one of the best demonstrations so far that we've had of leveraging the federal and state interests to better serve this population. So certainly as we talk about a more integrated and coordinated system, there will be absolutely a benefit to the dually eligible population, as we call them. But in terms of how the Medicare dollars fit into this, at present they don't. They still remain separate, and that's more a federal decision than any state decision. I hope that's getting at your question, and Marianne certainly has something to add.
Yeah, I guess from what you're telling me, from what I've seen, that it will remain separate for a while, but eventually be part of the whole picture.
Go ahead.
Well, just to add to that, I mean, certainly there are separate funding streams, and as Nathan mentioned, through our Health Home program, it's a way of blending those funding streams in a more coordinated fashion. But there are other opportunities that the state has, perhaps through some other initiatives that are happening at the federal level with what's called a special needs plan. And we're looking at other ways that we can better serve this population that are both Medicare and Medicaid eligible. So over time, looking at some different opportunities that may be available. But, you know, unfortunately, the programs have been somewhat separate for many years, so it's really been just the last few years where there's been really action at the federal level to really bring these programs together and an acknowledgement and recognition that we do have a significant population that are served by both systems, and those systems need to talk and coordinate.
Right, and you got some things that I heard from the parents of the special needs. And they were concerned because when it first started rolling out, it looked like they were going to receive the same care as everybody else. And many times they need special care. So will they still be able to get that?
Absolutely. I mean, these programs don't take away care. It's augmented care. It's better care. It's coordinated care. And I think for parents, too, particularly when you're referencing probably special needs children,
yeah.
That here's an opportunity to have better coordinated services through the various entities that provide services to these children.
So when all these things come together, and you talk about sharing the savings, where do the savings come from?
Sure. Well, one of the things that we've observed, and you know, this is a national discussion as well, is there is, because of lack of coordination, plenty of waste, plenty of overutilization that occurs across the delivery system. Largely, again, when systems don't talk to each other, when providers don't talk to each other, that drives a lot of this. So what we've done when we've done some research on similar models of integration to the one we're providing here is, there are demonstrated savings in these other models, some of them very limited in scope, some of them broader in scope, on account primarily of delivering better care. So what that does is it does reduce unnecessary utilization of services, at times utilization of services that's harming individuals. If we can serve someone better in the community, if we can serve someone better in an outpatient setting, for instance, or a more cost-effective setting, that's what we want to do. And what we're trying to assure through the Early Adopter Initiative is the financial incentives now actually support the policy sentiments that we have, and that's the opportunity here. It's very hard to do it in a fractured and fragmented system.
When we got started in this and we were looking for savings, we were looking at something like a clearinghouse. So, for example, if somebody went to the emergency room and they had a common cold, they would be referred down to a different clinic to avoid those costs of the emergency room. Is that where you think you're going to get some of those savings? Are we going to have something like a clearinghouse or somebody in the emergency that would turn non-emergencies into other facilities?
I think it's very probable that by aligning the financial incentives and the actual dollars that are in the system today, you're going to have entities, some of them represented even in the room today, managed care plans and delivery systems working very closely to avoid the unnecessary and costly utilization that no one benefits from. So I think, in fact, that this initiative, this intervention, will show evidence of reducing unnecessary emergency room utilization. That's a great example.
And I think even through the programs we have today and the managed care plans that we contract with currently in Clark County, they are demonstrating, and through their initiatives, to see things like reductions in unnecessary emergency room use, readmissions to hospitals, you know, doing that care coordination so people don't have to go back in if they don't get, the adequate discharge plan didn't happen, or somebody just wasn't able to manage at home as they thought they might be able to. So there are a number of things that are going on today, and this just augments it because now it builds across both delivery systems. It isn't just the physical health system, but it's also mental health and substance abuse.
Thank you.
So I want to deal with what I think is probably a little bit of a sensitive issue. As we streamline this and consolidate healthcare, I just have this little bit of fear that I don't want to end up seeing a program where a person, people on Medicaid frequently are very low income. And because you're low income and you are on Medicaid, for example, it may be your judgment that you need to seek a certain level of medical care. And I would be very, well, I would not want to see, let me just put it in the affirmative, I would not want to see any kind of a system where a person's belief in what they need would be usurped by sort of the control and the monitoring and the herding, where we're taking over, directing them to what kind of care they can have. Here's what we will allow you to do. And while we would be usurping that person's judgment. Now, that's tricky because there are people that maybe have mental challenges, or other things that would make it harder for the use of their judgment to be the most prudent. We all understand that, but tell me where the safeguards are so that this isn't government controlling and directing somebody's life regarding their medical.
And we wouldn't want that either.
Good.
So I think it's really important. That's part of, you know, working like through our managed care plans as an example, where they can provide those kind of supports to individuals that, for example, maybe have difficulty either finding care or don't know where to go, don't know where to ask, and get their questions answered. Maybe go to the emergency room because they don't have other resources. So, you know, helping that person say, gee, you know, if it's here's when you should go to an emergency room. But, you know, if you don't need to go, call your doctor, or here's an urgent care clinic, or here's alternatives for you, or here's a nurse line that you can call 24/7 and ask a question to, and they can help, you know, get you steered to the right direction. So I think it's setting up those supports and the education too, because a lot of it is just understanding even what's available and getting somebody certainly engaged and involved with a primary care provider, because a lot of that is really important, getting that relationship between you and your primary care provider, and you know where to go. So those are some of the tenets that are already built into the system, but we absolutely would not want, this isn't about government control, I mean, it really is about how to make care available in the most efficient and effective, I mean, it really is about the right care in the right place at the right time.
And I can hear that's not your intent, and I'm very relieved and pleased to hear. And this coordinated system, it sounds so forward-thinking and productive. It's as we expand government influence into the realm, I hope that we'll find checks and balances to check ourselves on that as well, that it doesn't become overwhelming to the patient.
Sure.
for reducing what could be some personal choices.
Sure, and that personal choice is key and critical to any system that we develop.
Thank you, I'm very sure to hear that.
And one other angle that we did address briefly in the slides is that angle of consumer choice.
Yeah.
And the competition of managed care organizations in every region, which we maintain as a principle in this, despite others maybe not even seeing it the same way. But one important element is if a consumer is not being well served by their plan or doesn't feel like they're being given the options or the right care or the right approach, they will always have the choice of seeking out care through a different managed care entity. That's another kind of safeguard, check and balance that puts the control more on the consumer side, and something we're pretty, not pretty, we're very committed to protecting.
Thank you.
I sit also on the RSN board representing Clark County, and as I hear you make your presentation, I hear the vast bandwidth, and what comes through here is some enthusiasm. You don't talk like a state agency. You talk like an innovator, inventor, problem-solving, practical, fast-moving, and you've taken on a challenge that is, I can't imagine, much more complex, challenging, multifaceted, siloed, segmented, all of those things, with all of these entities, the collection that are disconnected at this point, you've taken on a big challenge. But what I hear, not only with what you presented here, but also you've got an idealism and innovation and inventive kind of a makeup that I find really refreshing. This is kind of unfolded in a way that was, as I sit on the RSN board since 2013, all of us were new on that board. All three commissioners sat on that board with no experience. We inherited a relatively new RSN. And we saw this coming forward, the transition that existing RSN is going to have has to navigate, and not knowing what challenges were ahead, thinking we've got to be able to sail our ship from here to there, and it was undefined. And I must say that the experience thus far that has really changed from Clark, Cowlitz, Skamania County, to the point where now it's just Clark and Skamania, with the intention of integrating with Click-A-Tat, click attack has now dropped out. So we've navigated not only to from 3 to 2 to 3 to 2 counties, but we've also gone through that process with our own RSN, seeing the transitions ahead. And those individuals that want to have a continued employment, many of them are having to migrate out, including our CEO that left months ago. And that transition could set us up for vulnerability, for failure, for discontinuity, for all those things. But the exact opposite has happened. I see our executive director up there, Brian Cameron. You stepped in for months now, and the RSN staff has been stellar. In fact, our last RSN meeting was almost like a cheerleading session on my part, because it was so healthy. Those individuals that are leaving are setting us up for success to get a whole bunch of stuff prepared so that the rest of the staff can absorb that and before they move on. So it's not only the RSN, Dr. Ellen Melnick, especially Vanessa Gaston, your leadership in this has been excellent. Also, I can't take credit for the good things that are happening within the RSN. The Skamania County Commissioner Chris Brong has put in countless hours as the chairman of that RSN to navigate through and work with staff and work with Vanessa and work with just simply to bring definition to these things and get us through what could be troubling waters in a way that is solid, successful, healthy. Our patients are getting continued service without problems. We're staying in compliance. We don't have those kind of problems. And all of that to say that you're working with a really good local team.
We are.
Chris Braun, Brian Cameron, you're going to be leaving because you've got another commitment with Timberland RSN. And so we're going to be getting a new CEO, executive director for the RSN to help us navigate through. We have a very good candidate in mind.
Good.
So the confidence that we have, I want you to understand that you've got some experience working with this local RSN. I have all the more respect and enthusiasm and confidence in that leadership. So it's a big process. It's a big challenge. But that innovation for us to be able to have Clark County and Skamania County, the ability to lead the state and be the model of all others, I like that opportunity.
We do.
That's good. That's invention that works from the grassroots, bottom level first. You want to make it work for the counties first, because when the patients work, and the counties work, the local representatives are the primary stakeholders. This is, it's got to be successful at home first. Then the rest of them, we become the model for the rest. We'll become the guinea pig. We won't get everything right, but we'll work out those kinks and those details as we go. That just comes with the territory, but that's part of the prototyping process to finally nail it down and get it right. So please be patient with us as we go through those speed bumps together. So far, so good. Or in fact, so far, stellar. Yes, sir.
Part of the plan for today was to open the floor for questions.
Great.
From folks in the audience, and I think we have a question in the back. Do you need to have a comment?
No. Yes.
Right, before you start there, I'm still uneasy about a couple of things, maybe because I'm not clear. The term accountability starts with us. Is that through the transition, or will that continue after 2020? And the other thing that I'm uneasy about is the term coverage services list.
Sure. I can address the accountability question, and then I think Marianne can address the covered services question to add some clarity to the mix. With regard to accountability, I think what we're suggesting is a new norm, which is going to not change the fact that ultimately the state Medicaid program is run out of the healthcare authority. That doesn't change, and we ultimately have accountability to our legislative leaders and to CMS, the federal agency, to ensure the proper handling and conduct of that program. We are ultimately on the hook for that. That's what I mean by sustained accountability past 2016 and past 2020 and forever. That's going to be the case for the Medicaid program. The new normal is going to be a sharing of that accountability at the local level to ensure the success of this initiative. And that's not something that's going to go away. It's something we're committed to ensuring happens well and this region becomes a model of, so that as the counselor was describing, as other regions take hold of the early adopter initiative, we get this accountability thing ironed out. So we're actually going to count on you to help inform us on where we're doing good on that and where we're lagging on that, so that by the time we get to April 2016, we have a very clear, crisp understanding, and we have clear lines of accountability, both as it relates to the contracting aspect and also as it relates to the community aspect. You're starting from a place of great strength with the present RHA that you have, is my observation.
As things change and the dollars go different directions, I want to make sure that we don't get hung out on unfunded mandates of that sort.
Of course.
But we're part of the program still. We need to be funded for that part that we play.
Of course.
And then your question related to the benefits or the covered services. I mean, as part of the Medicaid program, we define a set of benefits. Much of it is in federal law, also in state law, in terms of what the coverage or what, just like you have with your own insurance, here's a list of things that your insurance covers. So if you think of Medicaid as an insurance company, which it really is today, it's just an insurance product for very low-income folks, that those are the things that are covered by your plan. So you are with a plan, and here's the things that you get from the plan. You know, if the concern is that there's a lot of leeway or about that, or there's more autonomy in who chooses what's covered or not, then that is something that we have in contract, that these are the services you must make available to the individuals. And like I said, most of Medicaid is highly defined by federal requirements, that if a state chooses to participate in the Medicaid program, these are the things you have to provide. You have to provide hospitalization and medication and a variety of different services. So I guess I would say it's rather closely regulated from the standpoint that you know, these services you as a health plan must provide to individuals who need them.
Yeah.
Does that answer your question?
It kind of does. And I guess I get to look south across the river into Oregon, and I recall a while back that a senior citizen was denied a certain care because of their age, and I would hate to have that erect.
It's really about, we have a standard that we call medical necessity. So if it's a covered benefit and a person needs it, they get that benefit, or perhaps there might be a substitute because there's something better or more appropriate. You know, I might think I need something, and then I go to the doctor, and well, you really don't need that, you need this. But to try to make sure that individuals get the services they need. Because what we're really working for is achieving health, to keep people healthy. And that's what's really important. So you need to have a full complement of services to do that.
Okay. I'll keep my fingers crossed.
Okay. We have a question. Okay, you have a microphone.
Good morning. My name is Dr. Melanie Meyer-Reno, and I've been your mental health ombuds for 10 years. I'm here today to say that I've never been more proud to work anywhere in my life, and proud to know the people I work with. I thank you very much for asking the question about what if a consumer believes they need something different. That's where I come into play, and I'd like to really ensure that the mental health ombud system of grievance is that checks and balance. I've always said that we've had some of the most innovative and sustainable services in the state, and I believe that it's because Clark County always went to the people and said, are you getting what you need? And are you happy with what you're getting? And so I hope that you will keep that in mind as you make contracts, as policies are implemented, as you all are voting on things, that you make sure that the consumer is remembered and that ombud services are still a way for people who believe they need something different. They can file a grievance and have resolution and relief through that process. It's always worked before. I have some concerns about it being with the managed care organization, but I really hope that you will continue to remember the consumer. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else?
Chris? If I may, counselors. On behalf of the council, I'm just going to ask a few questions to help inform them and maybe also inform myself. With regard to the 10% savings, I know in earlier discussions you had mentioned some flexibility in terms of what that money can be spent for by the board. Could you elaborate on that for council?
Sure. The legislature in the statute did not dictate any specific menu of services or line item expenditures that the money could be used for. Left open to our interpretation, we assume that that is the county's or region's decision to make. You need an effective approach for making that decision as a region. You have some assets already available to you in this region, like the RHA and others, where that can be discussed. But the statute leaves it in the county or county's hands as to what any shared savings investment would be spent on. In the discussions up until now with multiple communities weighing early adopter integration, I think there's been a consistent observation that would be best to reinvest those dollars back in those aspects of the delivery system that need the money, but the statute does not dictate a particular direction.
Thank you. Related to that same issue, in talking about the 10% and savings, it certainly makes sense that there's a requirement that we maintain the same levels of quality. The question, I guess, that I have related to that is, to the extent, is the 10% measure only measured against money that is saved, or to the extent quality is improved, not just maintained, is that 10% incentive recognized, that improvement in quality?
Great question. Our goal is not to limit the 10% share of savings, number one, and I want to be clear on that. Number two, I think the legislature was keenly interested in ensuring that we didn't bring up an initiative that saved a bunch of money but did it for all the wrong ways and reasons, if you will. So they wanted to ensure that consistent performance gain over the duration of the project. We have not developed, to your question, the quality and financial model, but through other initiatives that the HCA is undertaking now, are developing some competencies in this area that I think will very much apply to the early adopter initiative. There is more to come on that. The statute does dictate that it must reflect performance. It does not tell us how to do it. For the front end of calculation related to shared savings, we will know what expected quality and performance will be. We will not know what actual attainment. So there will be a measure of this that is front end, early investment, and there will be a measure of it that is back end, and the back end measure of it will certainly tie more explicitly to the quality, performance, or lack thereof. We believe it'll be improving, of course.
Okay. Speaking to the binding letter that you're anticipating on June 1st, my concern about the term binding is there's still more to come between the state and the RSN or the early adopter. Obviously, there's contract negotiations. So to the extent that there's a letter written, obviously it has to recognize that there will be ongoing negotiations to finalize that contract. That's going to be in our anticipated letter. I assume you understand that.
I think we understand it and expect it.
Okay. On a related issue, as we go forward and begin working with other entities, as you merge the three systems of care that are currently provided, we local RSNs and certainly counties and cities have to face the question of how to provide for the confidentiality of information under both HIPAA, under 7105 and 7002. Is there any help? Because we constantly battle, even 7002, while it does provide for some sharing of information among mental health or health care providers, it doesn't explicitly recognize the rights of, and especially given this merger of systems of care, it seems appropriate that the legislature should contemplate this merger and provide for the sharing of information as being not only authorized but contemplated, so that we don't have to try to fit in, because otherwise it's an exemption. The opening statement is it's prohibited. There's a special exemption and you have to qualify. There should be some express recognition of this so that going forward, part of the benefit of this is to be able to share information so that we have timely, informed care, and that would certainly benefit by improving that confidentiality provision.
We agree, and there is always a lot of confusion with regard to confidentiality data, especially in the behavioral health realm. To that end, we are working as part of a separate initiative around health information exchange that's housed within our agency on some guidance materials, not informed by us at our level of expertise, but by some of the nation's leading legal experts on the issue, because you're not the only one certainly suggesting that the state could provide greater clarity in its role as both a purchaser and a regulator. And that's something we have committed to do. I can't give you a precise timeline, but we think it's absolutely relevant and totally reasonable to request some further state guidance that clarifies it, at least to the degree we can. We can't rewrite statutes at our level, at least alone. We certainly need the legislature's involvement for that. But in terms of interpreting the varying levels of state and federal regulations on the subject, we do have a role to play, and we're committed to playing that role.
Thank you. Part of the reason and one of the important rationales for the county to explore early adopter is the fact that the board and the county want some local involvement in this future system of care. And I know that you've spoken a couple of different times in your presentation about strong county involvement. And I noticed that when you were describing performance measures, you talked about both local and state priorities, but actually I think your slide only refers to state priorities. What local input is going to be provided to counties going forward as a part of the early adopter process so we can participate in and contribute to this system of care?
Yeah, great question. I think on several fronts. Right now the input is most felt in the development of the contract itself, which will reflect those performance measures. So there's significant input there. There will be significant input and significant sharing of information on the feedback and monitoring side of things, as we've discussed. But I think what we've suggested is that input isn't just simply a two-way street of emails back and forth. It needs to be a broader community effort. And so the work that this region has done with its RHA over several years has actually helped us, I think, right in a different level of shared input and shared accountability than we have ever conceived of, at least in the present Medicaid program. Those details, this region gets to write some of those details as we move forward the early adopter projects. So I won't suggest, I don't think this morning, that every single one of them is lined up today, but the commitment is there, I think, from both sides of the equation. I think that's been felt in the development of the contract terms thus far, and I believe it will be felt as we move past June into implementation the following April. I hope that is addressing enough of your question.
Certainly.
Yep.
My last area of inquiry really has to do with, we'll deal with three subjects, but it really does involve the provision of care, and I'll just jump in. The county experiences, and every community experiences certain customers who the term or phrase frequent flyers has been used. We have a person, for example, who last year by June had already taken 200 ambulance rides because it was a convenient way to get to the store. The same is true of people who find it easier to go to the emergency room to cure an earache than it is to go to an emergency care clinic. What flexibility will be provided to the MCO or to the entity to give them the ability, recognizing their, I think the commissioner or the counselor talked about this difficult or tricky balance, but there does, of course, and I expect you will be holding us accountable or holding the MCO accountable for doing that balance to maintain costs. What flexibility will be provided to the MCO to accomplish that?
I can start, and then so several things that I would say first. One is when you have splintered financial accountability across delivery systems, it's hard to give any type of it's hard when accountability is split in three or four or five different domains depending on how you want to count it. So that's the first problem we're solving, I think, with early adopter integration, is the single line of accountability for that person and their care needs. The second piece relates to flexibility of managed care organizations, I think, to incentivize client behavior. They have actually significant flexibility to do this on at least one side of the ledger with regard to incentive programs and various plans that are already in this state have devised different strategies to encourage this right care, right place, right time notion that you've been sharing. One area of flexibility that's limited more by federal constraints than state constraints is in the area of member cost sharing for very low-income populations. The federal government does not allow much in the way of flexibility at the plan level, and this state, through its through the legislature, has yet to implement any type of provisioning for member cost sharing. So that's one tool that we don't have in the Medicaid toolbox and won't have short of legislative action. But there are many tools that the managed care plans themselves could probably articulate even better than I could, of steering member behavior and steering it towards the best possible use of our very limited healthcare resource, steering people away from the emergency room when it's unnecessary, steering people away from a costly service when a less costly and more appropriate service is available. So we can certainly articulate that more through our plans or whatever device you'd like.
And I would just add that we're seeing some very innovative things happening in many communities around, you know, the example that you gave, and I think these community partnerships that we're building have really kind of expanded the capacity. For example, you know, the EMTs, EMS getting more involved and having, you know, being engaged around care managing somebody who calls the ambulance for services that perhaps could be delivered in a different way. So there's a lot of unique projects and programs and things that we're seeing to solve local community level at the local community level. And these are things that the managed care plans have, you know, significant autonomy around.
Related to that issue, currently under 7105-120, there's immunity provided for local governments to the extent they're acting in good faith and not grossly negligent in the performance of their services. Given the overlap frequently between mental health and physical care, is there any contemplation at the legislative level that going forward, immunity may be available to local governments or providers in this area?
You know, I'm not aware of any specific, at least this last session, legislative discussions on that subject. I do know that our interpretation of 7105-120 is that it certainly applies to those same duties that will be taking place under the early adopter initiative. I have not heard discussions up until now of extending that immunity to expand beyond the behavioral health domain that 7105 reflects. That doesn't mean they won't happen in the future. I think this initiative, and I think what the legislature expects is we need to make or propose statutory changes, that those ideas are made coming as much from the community as they're coming from state agencies to improve whatever statutory constructs might be getting in the way of us being fully and truly innovative in improving the performance of the delivery system. But this is an area where I have not heard legislative discussion.
Okay, and just one last question. Thanks for bearing with me. In terms of the covered services that will be covered at, or that MCOs will be responsible for providing, I understand there's a definition of covered services, and I just wanted to ask you a couple of examples of, in terms of how those would be provided for or contemplated. Typically, areas that we see as a county that particularly are a strain or a challenge tend to be transplant issues, providing transplant services, kidney, liver types of services, some types of cancer, and especially experimental medication and cancer treatment. Each of those areas provide unique and very difficult challenges to any system. And my question for you is, how is this plan going to define these areas as covered services or not, or a combination of covered and not?
So, and you give a couple of examples like transplants or as one. We do have a definition of what we call medical necessity. So we have to look at meeting that definition of medical necessity. And as part of that, there is language around when it's appropriate to cover experimental or investigational. So there's opportunities to do that. And we do oversee our managed care plans to make sure that they're using that regulatory framework in making their decisions. And we do look at, we go out and monitor the plans at least annually and look at things like denial to make sure that those are being handled appropriately so that someone is not denied a service because of its cost, for example. And, you know, frankly, if we have to intervene in those, we do. And work closely between our medical director and the plan's medical director to determine what's appropriate for that individual. Because we really want to make sure that no one is being denied a service just because it's expensive.
Excuse me, I believe we're near the end, but even so, I would like people to take a 5-minute break, please.
There is another activity in here at 11. Tony Nolik, our prosecuting attorney, is doing state of the office.
I have no other questions. Thank you very much, counselors, and thank you.
So if we could wrap it up in the next few minutes, I
have one particular area of interest, and that is you talked about tools in the toolbox, equipping for success. And I'll couple that with no unfunded mandate, we're on the same page there. The integration, the information management, all of the that translates in my eyes to a very necessary piece of equipment or a tool. It's software, it's database management. There's each of the RSNs now, most of them have unique proprietary software that's very expensive. There's no connection. If we are looking at a clean piece of paper to equip and say, here's the model, one of those, if there's going to be shared information, standardized, adopted, well-functioning tools, I would very much encourage whatever's going to be adopted here, if it doesn't exist, we ought to be able to somehow define what is that tool and standardize that across the others. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise we're going to end up with more segment, proprietary, all of that. I'm not aware of anything in the works right now. Is there something in the works? We know how not to do software without healthcare.org, right?
There's that. There's a few things in the works, and I don't want to belabor the point given time, but we can certainly follow up with you on some specifics. But our plans, our managed care plans today, as well as the state under its Medicaid Health Information Technology Plan, are making strides towards at least a standardized approach to sharing clinical data, which seems to be one of the bigger challenges at a delivery system level and at a plan level. And so some investments are in fact being made in some very core infrastructure that can be used to do the very things you're suggesting, which is standardize that information transfer, as well as give access to the necessary parties, but also ensure from a security and privacy framework that personal and individual privacy is being protected at all times. That does take investment. Some of that investment is being made. This particular tool may not meet all of the information management needs, and I actually am certain it will not. But all of our plans also bring some new capacity and new thinking to the table in this regard as we merge the care delivery systems more tightly together. I think we will be learning a lot, and like you, I hope that what we learn can be scaled across the state so we are not making costly investments either on the private sector or public sector side that are in fact unnecessary. So we are trying to do our part. The state will not have the full solution, but we are trying to provide appropriate public infrastructure and tools to make this data sharing landscape a little bit easier to tolerate, again, at a delivery system and at a plan level. So more to come there, and we're happy to unpack that further for you if you'd like.
And I'm glad to hear that some thought and some work is going into defining the common standard to comply with, to facilitate the exchange and the sharing of HIPAA-protected information. That sounds like it would be the first step. But the other step, at least the other to implementation of that, identification, RFP, whatever, to have that implemented so that we can adopt that, we can start using that, and we can be ensuring that facilitates, that's part of the system. We have the structure of the organization, but we also have the tools. And we're missing the tools right now. So I really encourage that I see that as a necessary foundation. Necessary tool.
Thank you.
Anything else?
So
So I just want to make a comment to the group. To the providers and also to the counselors, because there was some concerns, and I want to appreciate Isabel and Jenny and the Department of Social Health Services for coming up with this idea. It was not an idea, but it's actually what needs to happen. So I want to share with you guys. So the contract between Southwest Behavioral Health and DSHS ends for the RSN, for all RSNs, March 31st, and either you're going to a BHO or early adopter. The providers were concerned about how do they get paid for March services. And what DSHS had shared is that come January, the Southwest Behavioral Health will need to turn in a 90-day plan for when the RSN ends, how will you close out and pay all any kind of liabilities and claims and all that. So they give them a 60-day period from April through May to make all of those payments. And so they can keep some reserves. And so since the RSN will actually officially end, we'll need to work between the counties and Southwest Behavioral Health about how do we do those payments for April and May. So I want to reassure the providers you will get paid for March, and there will be a 60-day transition period. So for those providers in the audience, please rest assured you will get paid for those months.
And the June 1st is coming along really soon. You spoke of the necessity of a binding letter. Do we know exactly what's necessary to be the content of that letter?
We will be providing that within hours, days? What is it?
Tomorrow.
Yeah, we had that scheduled for board time this afternoon. We're moving it to next week.
Okay.
Because of the coordination that's occurring.
For me, it would also be important to have just a white paper for the counselors indicating where this transition is in the payment system, just as you've outlined here, so that we can understand what is phased out, what is being phased in, what the timetable is. And because if we get feedback from providers they haven't been paid, we all know what that setup is. I didn't remember at all. If we have that available, that'd be great.
I want to thank our county manager, Mark McCauley, for arranging all of this. You've been hitting home run after home run here.
Vanessa told me to do this, so.
Even better, sharing the credit. Give the credit to someone else. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And
thanks for you folks coming down. Very informative, very professional presentation. Thank you.
And thank you for the opportunity. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.